Okay. Let's step into hour number two. This is going to be very interesting. We don't talk about this often enough, and it is without question one of the greatest scourges of humanity. It's spelled in three letters. It's not sex, although a lot of you probably would suggest that. A double-edged scourge, that one. It's called tax. And over here we call it the IRS, another three-letter acronym in this case. But we understand that tax never has a good connotation. And there's a man who has been heroically fighting the system, the IRS, for some time now, and has spent a lot of money, to put it mildly. He is on our homepage. You've seen the very large banner with text in it, down below the banner for Dana Durnford. It's been up for months now. And the man is extraordinary. His name is John Trowbridge, T-R-O-W-B-R-I-D-G-E. We'll get him to tell us more about himself in a couple minutes. But this issue is one that I hope you read and I hope you follow, because it is being updated as it moves through the system. It's a very big issue, to put it mildly. The IRS code, the tax code, is I don't know how many volumes of printed papers it comprises itself with, but it is huge. Quite literally, no one has ever read it all. No one understands it, especially the people in the IRS. There are exceptions and rule changes and variations and you name it in the tax code that no one will ever unearth. And if they did, it could overturn the whole thing. The whole thing is illegal anyway and unconstitutional. So let's with that say hello to John Trowbridge. Welcome, John, to the program.
Jeff, thanks for the opportunity to share my story.
Oh, yeah, it's an amazing story. Tell us, our listeners, just a lie. You always do it better than I, people who are involved in this. A little bit about yourself. What do you think people need to know about you?
Well, you know, Jeff, in 1981 or 82, I had an accountant who proposed an investment that would help, you know, with tax advantage and such. And about 8 years later, the Internal Revenue Service was collecting from me $65,000 of what they call a recapture. And that was a shocker. I mean, this came from my accountant.
A recapture. I've not heard that. So that's in other words, they came at you basically out of the blue and said, by the way, we've recalculated and you owe us $65,000 more.
Yeah, they disallowed the investment. They said it wasn't qualifying. Well, I didn't know anything about it. That's an accountant specialty.
That's what you pay them for.
Exactly. So I was complaining to a friend of mine who said, oh, here's some stuff you can start to read. And so I started reading, and I got more confused and more confused. And
oh, yeah.
I think that's what people do, is they finally give up.
Sure they do.
I didn't give up. I found on the instruction booklet for the 1040 form that if you have a question, you can write a letter to the district director for the IRS, and he'll give you guidance in correctly filing your taxes.
That's the rules. In other words, you can get help from the district director with your return if you need it. That's what his responsibility is. Okay.
Exactly. That was in August of 1992, and actually the response kind of startled me, as it probably would startle everybody, and that is the government follows a policy of never respond, confirm, or deny. Never respond, confirm, or deny. And that's exactly what I got. No response, no confirmation, no denial.
No discussion.
Nothing whatsoever after many, many letters to the district director.
Well, I know that scene. It's called the silent treatment, and it is one of the most abusive things there is between people.
The culture of silence.
Yeah. Okay. So you started reading. I assume you didn't write him a check for $65,000.
Oh, no, that was back in the 80s. This is now in the 90s, and I'm going, why in all of my reading can I not figure this out? And I just wanted to follow the rules. I asked him three questions. What statute requires me to pay, and what regulations do I follow in order to know how much and where and when and such? And is this voluntary or mandatory?
Those are real simple, basic questions that are about as basic as they can get, right?
Kind of H&R Block type questions, you know?
Yeah.
So I figured I'd get an answer back. And they kept sending me bills and demands, and I just kept writing letters to the district director saying, I'm still waiting for your help on this. Never got it.
No answer.
No. Well, the only thing I did get was from them was an invitation for an audit.
What do you mean an invitation? A command or an invitation?
Well, I have since learned they're all just invitations, but they sure look like a command.
Oh, really? So the okay, this is going to interest a lot of people. An
yes.
audit is something that is voluntary, technically?
Well, actually, they have no authority to compel me to participate in an audit.
Oh.
But they threaten you and say, you know, you'll just go to jail and whatever. And they make life miserable out of fear. You know, death of a spouse or a child is a pretty serious event. But very much up there is an unexpected letter from the IRS. That strikes fear in most everybody.
Well, yeah, and they know it, sure.
Yes, they do.
Okay,
yes,
go on.
Do.
Yeah.
Well, at the first audit in 1996, the auditor told me that I was to file a Form 1040. Now, I had to push to get this information. And then I said, now, is this the determination of the district director that I've been seeking after many, many, many letters? He said, yes, it is. And I said, great. Could you please put that in writing for me so that I have that to rely on? And I instructed my accountant to go ahead and prepare the forms 1040 as instructed, but on each of them I included an extra statement, and this is called a disclaimer. I said, you know, I'm doing this because I'm respecting that I was ordered to do so, but I don't think it's right because I don't have the correct statute and regulations that I requested, and I don't want to volunteer if this isn't the correct thing to do.
So, in other words, what you're saying is you were filing under duress of lack of knowledge. So you
correct.
Can't. You're saying I can't be held accountable for something I do here because they're not giving me the rules and regulations.
That's correct. And I crossed out the JURAP. That's the thing where I say I swear under penalty of perjury that this is correct.
Yeah.
Because I
don't know.
Know.
You'd be lying in either case if you signed that.
Exactly. So they got a little upset with that, and in 1999 re-audited and re-extended the audit. Now we're looking at 8 years of audit.
Oh, God.
And and now they kept saying, you know, you owe us a small fortune. Well, okay. The next thing I knew, I was... I was being investigated by a criminal grand jury.
This is like the Inquisition.
This it is like an Inquisition.
Yeah.
And the Department of Justice, you know, I mean, it is very impressive stationery and a big title, and all the people carry badges and whatever.
Now they carry guns.
Uh-huh. They do that, too. The Criminal Investigation Division does do that. I actually had a nice meeting with three of the CID agents down at the IRS office. I brought my own CID agent. I'm sure you've heard of Joe Bannister.
You bet. None better. None more
none
heroic.
Better. And
yeah.
So Joe is sitting next to me while I'm trying to say I still don't know what I'm supposed to do, and they're saying, you know what you do, just do it. And it went back and forth like that. And, you know, I'm simplifying what was literally 100 lineal feet of binders of letters that I sent to them and documents that I sent to them and so on over the 20-some years. Well, at that point, when I contacted the U.S. attorney here in Houston, said, am I under criminal investigation? I finally got an answer, and the answer was yes. So I said, hey, you know, I really insist on testifying before the grand jury.
Good for you.
And, well, that has an interesting implication, Jeff. It's kind of something I didn't realize at the beginning but later found out.
Uh-huh.
If you are called or hauled before a grand jury, you can just say, you know, I'm not going to answer any questions because I don't know if they might incriminate me or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And if you insist on presenting to the grand jury, you have waived any Fifth Amendment reservations. You answer everything.
Oh, I didn't know that. That is interesting.
And I was not fearful about answering anything. In fact, I had an opportunity to educate 24 grand jurors on how hard it is to get an answer.
Wow.
So,
the grand jury consists of 24 people?
I think it's 23 in general, although it may be lesser or more, whatever.
Yeah, it is a very large group. Interesting.
It's a grand jury.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're supposed to stand between the government and the people so that the man or woman on the street is protected from tyranny by the government. But that's not at all the way it seems to work.
No.
So for 7 years, I was under investigation. And every month I sent a letter to the U.S. attorney requesting to testify and providing him documents that I wanted to present to the grand jury. Now I finally got a letter from him. Stop writing me. Your case has been referred to Washington. Deal with them. Okay. I'll do that. So I did that. And they, you know, the old story, never respond, confirm, or deny.
Yeah.
And that's what I got out of Washington. So,
never respond, never confirm, never deny, never engage, never answer.
It's a culture of silence.
Very, very cruel to anyone with a mind to not be answered if one asks a sincere question or makes a sincere inquiry, which you were doing all the time. Very cruel.
Repeatedly. You know, Jeff, I think most Americans, you know, as a people, we are pretty straightforward. We're pretty level-headed. We're pretty straight arrows, you know. Oh, yeah, we may bend a little bit here and there, but for the most part, we want to follow decent, reasonable rules.
We want to go along to get along. Sure, of course.
Exactly. And you know, when you say to yourself, I can't understand this, and you ask an accountant who says, yeah, that's a good question. I think the only one who can answer that under the law is the district director, and then you find out you can't get an answer.
Yeah.
This is kind of funny because I did sue the district director in the federal district court here in Houston, and the Department of Justice moved to have it removed, you know, because it wasn't something the court could deal with. Well, I had really no idea. This is 15 years ago. I had no idea really how to play that game. And indeed, it was thrown out. And, you know, I thought this is odd because I have paid the fees for a specific determination letter by the district director laying out, here's the statute, here's the regulations, pay your money, okay? And I paid for several of those, and they would not come, and they would not come, and so on. So I kind of thought, you know, we kind of had a contract. They kept the money and didn't produce the letter. That was kind of odd. That was odd. Then I did apply to the national office of the IRS for their, it's called a private letter ruling. It's kind of like a determination letter, but it's on a specific case that the national office will handle. They were kind enough to return the money and say, we aren't going to tell you.
Unbelievable.
Well, I kind of thought so. I was running out of options.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how many years at this point?
Well, let's see. It started in 92, and by the time of the national letter, it's, I think it's around 2004, 2005.
So they yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, they took 14 years of your life.
Lots of
so
letters.
Far.
Lots of letters at that point, yes.
At this point, yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead. That's fascinating.
And, well, Jeff, you know, a couple of years ago, they decided to go ahead and play hardball, and they filed liens against me and anything they could find in my name. And
on what grounds? To failure to pay?
I had taxes outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, here's the funny thing. I never, ever resisted or fought the government over any of this. I just kept saying, which one? Just tell me which one. There's a statute that says here's the tax, And then there's regulations that tell you where to send your money, what rate you'll use, and so on. That's all on the regulations.
Sure.
And those, the regulations are for a particular tax. That's what they call it. And the particular tax is named in the statute.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know that there's like 110 or more different kinds of income taxes?
No.
Yeah, well.
I never would have guessed that many.
Well, which one do you want to pay? Number one or number 59 or number 87? What?
Yeah, and if you ask, you won't get an answer. And if you do get an answer, you may not understand it. Oh, I paid my share in taxes. They'll take 30% of what I make. So
easily.
You know, why make it? I don't understand. It gets to the point where you start to question yourself.
Well, and that's the problem is, you know, I have no real problem with taxes. The Constitution allows taxes, but they are very specific kinds. And actually, you know, we're talking about taxes on things that come into the country. That's called customs and duties and imposts and such. And then there's excise taxes on the sale of particular products, and those are outlined. And then there's a direct tax that can actually be levied on the state capitals. And, I had to learn all this stuff and trying to figure out what is going on here.
You know, I should say one other thing. They'll take 30% of what I make, but people never understand when they see an income figure, they don't understand the difference between gross income and net income. I have enormous operating costs. I have huge taxes. And what's left over is marginal. Marginal.
Right.
And that's the truth.
That's the net. That's the net.
That's your net.
Right
and,
there.
Yeah, and it's nothing like people would think. Nothing.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's just like, you know, think doctors make a lot of money, dentists make a lot of money, and so on, except their operating expenses are horrendous.
Oh, and their insurance bills are equally as huge. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the story is that, you know, if nothing can be said to be certain, as Ben Franklin said, except death and taxes, my question is, which kind of taxes should you pay? Well, you should pay your highway taxes and your gasoline taxes and your tire taxes and, you know, your alcohol taxes and so on, because those are all excise taxes that are built into the product.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
But, you know, I was still struggling. Which of the income taxes am I really liable to pay? Because I couldn't find the circumstances under which that was the case. Well, you know, when they file a lien on you, Jeff, this was a surprising thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
When they file a lien, they state what kind of taxes, and it says 1040. Okay. Well, if that's a kind of tax, I went to Title 26, the Internal Revenue Code, and went to Section 1040, and that has nothing to do with me. Well, then, is that a form, 1040? Well,
1040 is a 1040 not just a form?
It's a form, but they call it, on the lien papers, they call it kind of tax.
A tax.
A kind of tax. So, you know, I'm presuming they mean the 1040, but, you know, I could never get them to tell me in writing that that was the correct one. So this was frustrating. So I requested what they call a collection due process hearing. And, you know, they have real strict rules. You've got to do this, you've got to do that. So I did it within the 30 days every time they filed a levy or a lien, okay?
Okay.
Or a levy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? Do you know that they considered that every one of my collection due process hearing requests was improper and therefore did not qualify?
They were hassling you. They were trying to make you. They were tormenting you. They were acting outside the law, or certainly the spirit of the law, it sounds
right.
like to me.
Well, I think tormenting is a very good phrase, Jeff. You kind of pinned it down, because you can't really figure out how your life is going when Moby Dick has its eyes on you, okay?
No, you never know when you're going to be taken out of the game. That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, thing. I'm sorry.
Well, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, they would take money out of the bank account. Now, how do you make payroll? And I'd say, you know, that isn't my bank account. That's the business bank account. Nope, it's yours. You have the business. It's yours. Okay. Well, you know, that's frustrating. And then, you know, I'm trying to figure out, what do I do now, because these guys are getting real bloody with me. And the next thing I know is the Department of Justice files a suit in the Federal District Court in Houston to take my house.
Oh, my God.
Well,
did you ever meet one human being along the way from the other side at this point so far? One human being?
At this point, I have had the opportunity to meet two auditors and three criminal investigation agents. So that's it. And actually, there were a couple of other in the audit branch that I met. One of them I kind of had to order out of the room because he was being a jackass. So, you know, he shouldn't try and confuse the issues because he's a manager there. So anyway, that's my sum total there. Okay. Well, when they want to take your house, that's, as I say it, getting kind of close to home. And I had to scramble.
That is home. Oh, my God, they're trying yes. to take your home. And what is more important than your home? Not much.
Not a whole lot. You can ride a bicycle to work, but where do you stay, you know?
Yeah.
So
they really went after you. God.
They went. And I thought it's kind of unfair not ever telling me what I should do in order to follow their law. So I found all sorts of things on the internet about how to respond to something like this. So I picked one and said, okay, tell you what, I will pay the tax right now if you will show me evidence that I am a citizen or resident of the United States. Because if you look in the law, mm-hmm. the people who pay the taxes
are
citizens or residents of the United States.
Yeah. So you got them there, and what are they going to say? How do they prove
well,
it? How do they try to prove it?
What they say is, of course you are.
That's not proof.
They say, well, everyone knows you are.
That's not proof. They didn't ask
right.
me. I could have proved it, but they didn't ask me.
Well, I'll tell you what. I need you to share with me a wonderful experience of being in the presence of God. Okay?
Right. Yeah, let's go ahead, Todd. I want to hear this. Go on, John, please.
All you have to do is walk into a federal district courtroom.
There's God.
And, and God wears a big black robe.
Mm-hmm.
I think
and
you
what wear
he
a
says,
white robe, but I understand.
Yeah, no. And what he says is real, and that's it. Done deal.
Wow.
So he would answer questions that I didn't ask in my filings, and he would, you know, they set up a straw man, okay? You know what that is? It's like, that's not really what you said, but we're going to knock this down, and you'll think that the other thing got knocked down. I kept challenging the jurisdiction for several different grounds, because I could find, by now I'm spending, you know, 12 hours a day researching this, and I could find all these things that proved all these years that my questions were correct. And, you know, it was denied here, denied there, and so on. And finally, the judge rules against me, and he wants to order me out of the house in 7 days.
Your home.
My home. And my home for 15 years at that point. And, just 11 years at that point, whatever. And the IRS, the assistant U.S. attorney was willing to, say 30 days. Well, they compromised and he ordered me out in 14 days in June. And it's like, have you ever tried to get a moving company in June when everybody is moving?
No, this is really a horror story. Yeah.
Oh, it's like Kafka, you know, I'm like the state has grabbed me and is, you know, strangling me.
Yeah.
I filed an emergency extraordinary motion with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, which was promptly denied. What I wanted them to do was just hold the sentence until my appeals were completed. And that way, you know, if I won, I wasn't out of the house. If I lost the house anyway. And I even offered to pay rent during the time of the appeals.
Because this is unbelievable.
Well, if it was their house, you know, I would owe them rent. So, no, the Fifth Circuit denied that. So the next thing I have is five federal marshals in their flak jacket and a county police officer and an IRS agent there for my eviction.
Guns?
I told the marshals, I said, look, guys, come on now. I'm a real people like you're a real people. And, you know, I think that this is an unlawful order, but I'm not going to create grief to anybody. The judge said it, and until I have some other evidence otherwise, I'm going to do what the judge says. I'm not going to give you guys any grief.
Yeah.
And and it turned out they were quite gentlemanly about it, too. And you know, I left a great deal of my personal gatherings over the last lifetime, you know, and, you know, stuff that you think, oh, God, I didn't get this or that or the other that was given to me by my parents or by a friend or whatever. And it's like, yeah, that got, got donated, I understand. Apparently a lot of my stuff was, quote, worthless, so it was just donated.
This is horrific. This is America. God. Go ahead, John. This is really simple.
Jeff, do you need to take a break? I'm just talking all the time here.
No, right? You go ahead. No, you're the only man to tell the story, and you're doing marvelously
okay.
at it. We have, we're about halfway through here, so a little bit more.
Great.
Than that,
so just so you well, know. Interrupt me at any point, okay?
Yeah.
You know, Jeff, what I was sore discouraged when the Fifth Circuit came back on the determination of the appeal. And basically repeated everything that the judge in Houston had said. And, like, you know, you're just, you know, a stinking person. And of course you're going to go to hell in a handbasket and whatever. And of course you're wrong on every point. But, you know, they said things and I'm looking at this and I'm going, you guys said that I said I wasn't a citizen of the United States. And then, but you say, of course I am. I didn't say that. I said, could you please show me evidence that I am a citizen of the United States? Because I know where I live. I live in Texas, and Texas is in the United States of America. Okay? Well, you know, they start kind of throwing these terms around, and you start misunderstanding, and you start getting confused again on your own points, and they rule against me, and they go, well, what do you do now, Ollie? And there was only one more thing to do, and that was to petition for a rehearing with the Supreme Court. So I spent countless hours preparing a petition and saying to the Supreme Court, you know, this is the U.S. Supreme Court. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., yes.
Yeah, just want to make sure that people didn't think it was Texas. All right.
No, it's the Supreme Court in D.C., and... I wait the appropriate number of days when they usually take to come up with an answer, and the answer is the petition has been denied. Okay. Well, I...
What did Joe say about all this? Are you still in touch with Joe?
Oh, I'm in touch with Joe, but, you know, Joe's doing his own struggles with these guys, too, you know.
Yes.
And you know, so I've talked to, you know, people that I've known over the last 20-some years and whatever, and I realized, wait a minute, I have one more chance, and that's called a petition for rehearing with the Supreme Court. Now, that means you can bring up an issue that is inside the case but is not the substance of your original petition. It's got to be a different point.
Oh, interesting.
Okay?
You can change directions on them a little bit then. Okay.
A little bit, yes, and say, well, this other point matters too. You have 90 days to prepare your first petition. You have 25 days after they say denied to submit your second petition. Now, I don't know if your listeners know, but a petition to the Supreme Court costs about $7,200 to get processed and printed and served. It's quite a joy, quite a joy. So I waited a while, and the petition comes back that the deal is denied. And the petition for rehearing was on an interesting point, and that is that when I was in the Houston case, the federal district court, with
right.
regard to my house, the judge was talking with the United States attorney and said, so is there one of his tax returns in your filings? And he said, no, we didn't see any reason to put that in. And he said, well, I want you to give me one of those objectionable returns is what he called it, and the deal is that, you know, he just wanted the first couple pages, but you can also give me anything else that you find of interest in it. So they gave the entire return, including what I told you was the disclaimer statement, and the judge ordered him to do it, and then ordered him in writing to do it. It was a written order to do it. And then it was never mentioned again.
Hmm.
Well, so I'm thinking about this. One of my friends says, well, you know about the election to be treated as a citizen or resident of the United States. And I didn't quite know what they were talking about. But it turns out it's in the Internal Revenue Code. And I'm looking at this, and it's like, if you file a return, a 1040, okay, you're, in effect, asking them to treat you like you're a resident or a citizen of the United States. And it hadn't occurred to me in in putting all this together and in filing my original petition to the Supreme Court, it's like, wait a minute. The judge got something that he considered a jurisdictional point, okay? Because I kept saying, you don't have jurisdiction. I can't see where your jurisdiction is. And that's what he was relying on. And that's what the petition for rehearing was about. I realized this is something new that I never saw that they sure hit me blindside with, okay?
Now, which judge is this?
Judge Hughes in Houston.
Okay.
Senior judge in Houston, senior mm-hmm. federal district judge.
Mm-hmm.
And the petition for rehearing, I thought, okay, boy, this is great because it's clearly in the record and it clearly is in the statutes and it clearly was used against me, and there clearly is not a jurisdiction that, you know, that they could really hang their hat on, and the petition was denied. Okay.
Do they ever tell you what grounds they're denying you on?
Oh, the Supreme Court just says the petition for rehearing is denied.
That's it.
Okay, that's it. Now, it's interesting, one of the Supreme Court justices back in 1953, Justice Jackson, said, we are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible
He actually used that word. Go ahead.
Yes, mm-hmm. in his opinion. And I think it's Brown versus Allen.
Mm-hmm.
But we are infallible only because we are final. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mm-hmm. if the policy in the government is never respond, admit, or deny, okay, that means that there isn't a case out there in which you can point to it and say, hey, I challenged the jurisdiction, and indeed I was right. They just ignore it. They just go on. And then when you finally get to the Supreme Court, they just say denied. And that's it. They're final. Wow. Wow.
What this is, you went into the inner core of the beast. And
yeah. Right. And I found that the beast has a big roar and big teeth. Big teeth. But there's a saving grace. And this is the excitement that I really kind of have about this, because at the same time, the Houston case was proceeding, and then it had concluded, and I was now appealing to the Fifth Circuit. They filed a suit in the federal district court in Lufkin to take the little weekend place that I have up in the country.
Oh, God.
Well, I offered in Lufkin the same as I did in Houston to pay everything within 10 days if they would produce evidence that I am a citizen or resident of the United States.
See, you were doing something extraordinary. You weren't offering just to pay it to get them off your back. You wanted something back, something very basic, very
sure.
obvious.
Yeah, just
you
show me that I come within
on,
the law.
You were standing on principle. That's right.
And the law. And the law.
Exactly.
That's what the law
oh, yeah.
says.
Of course.
Well, instead of showing me evidence, which they couldn't because it does not exist, in Houston, they opted for 4 months of pretrial motions and litigation. But, you know, in Lufkin, it turned out they went for 14 months.
My God, 14. And they're spending taxpayers' money on this? This is unbelievable.
Yes. Well, when I moved for the Lufkin judge to recuse himself for incompetence by reason of ignorance of the law, and I included evidence and proof of that, he went silent and disappeared. Never heard from him again.
Did he leave the courtroom? Just walk out?
No, I just filed a motion, and I don't know what happened. I don't know what he did. But
man.
But that was interesting. And I thought, wait a second, this is kind of the first real break in the case all of a sudden I must be doing something right. Okay.
It's a little bit daylight all of a sudden in the dark.
Little glimmer, exactly.
Okay. Hold on a minute, John. We do have
sure.
to pause now. When we come back, we're going to have about 13, 14 minutes. So we want to kind
Great.
Of get to the punchline and direct everybody
good.
To John Trowbridge on the homepage at Rents. Look for the text box up at the top. It's not at the very top, but it's up there above the splash. And you will see the latest on this. This man has fought something that is extraordinary. Hold on, we'll be right back. Okay, we continue with John Trowbridge. And again, you can find the latest on John's heroic efforts here on the homepage. He's got a big banner up there with a lot of text in it. Read it and stay up to date. You'll understand. A lot of you will be very, very interested in this because you have had similar problems, perhaps. Not exactly like these, but problems are problems with the IRS and the court system. Go ahead, John, please.
Well, Jeff, let me just thank you for a minute because you made it possible for me to put that banner up there months ago.
Oh,
as I started my website in order to kind of lay out this whole legal story as it was happening.
Sure.
And now I've put on the website all the documents that I have filed all the way through the case. And I really appreciate that because you have some very, very interested readers. Okay.
This is the best audience in the world in talk radio, and I say that with all humility. You people are, they are extraordinary. Yeah,
I agree. Now, here's, you know, as I was thinking during the break, it almost sounds like, boy, I'm an expert on this. I am not at all. I can't persuade you about anything. I'm just sharing successes, but the successes came from a very specific thing. I finally determined the precise words to challenge the constitutional authority of the Lufkin Court. Now, I wish I had known this for the Houston Court.
So it's a matter of form. The words have to be in the right form to force them to respond. Is that what you're saying?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny, because when I got the precise words, the judge and the Department of Justice attorneys went and have remained silent. That
what?
Was
they haven't said a thing, because you found that you got the key for the lock.
They went away. They walked away. So,
wow.
I can't tell you I'm any expert. I just happen to have been successful on this. Now, here's what I think is going on, and I'm pretty sure this is it, okay? Jurisdiction is considered in a geographical sense, okay? I'm here, you're there, whatever. I don't follow the laws of France because I'm not there, okay?
Got it.
But the Supreme Court has declared that the Constitution must have given the court the capacity to take jurisdiction. This is a very simple concept. The court has to be invested with a capacity to take jurisdiction over an area that a statute of Congress has given them an opportunity to have jurisdiction. So if it doesn't have the capacity, it can't take jurisdiction, and it's not authorized to act. And that is the hoax of federal jurisdiction. There is no contemporary federal court in America that is authorized to exercise jurisdiction. They are all Article IV legislative courts of general jurisdiction with authority only in the District of Columbia, period.
Oh, my. Oh.
Now, the District of Columbia includes the territories and such. That's just fluff. Now, the key is that statutes passed by Congress, you know, Jeff, they list all these obligations and such that we're supposed to pay attention to. They apply only to the residents of the geographic area in which Congress have exclusive legislative power. That's the District of Columbia and the territories. And
Puerto Rico, et cetera. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Now Jeff, what struck me is this. It's simple. If there's no provision of the Constitution that gives the court the authority to take jurisdiction in my case, and no one can produce any, the case disappears. They have no standing at that point.
No, they have no standing. Exactly.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's why they remain silent. You know, they're faced with the ultimate controlling law. That's the Constitution. And they can't move forward without betraying their oath of office and producing evidence of their treason to the Constitution. And treason's a pretty strong crime.
Unbelievable. It's really that simple.
Oh, my God.
It's that simple, but it's that complicated. I got it. No, nobody will. No, this is astonishing.
Well, you know, what happened, and I'm going to take 2 minutes if I can, and just explain where it went off the rails, okay? Because this was planned. This was absolutely planned. Back in the 1860s when we were fighting the Civil War, Congress redefined some just common words in the Constitution,
right,
like state and United States and such. Well, everybody knew what those meant. I mean, that was pretty obvious, right? Except when they redefined them, the actual and ultimate definition is the District of Columbia.
That's
and
it.
So when you read it, you go, well, I'm in a state, but that law only refers to District of Columbia. And let me tell you how I found out. This is so incredible. I found from the British Law Dictionary, this is where it gets really crazy, there are standards of interpretation of the statutes. You have to know these ways in which you interpret a statute. And if you don't know it, those rules of construction are used by the Congress. Okay, this is how they do it. They are hidden even from the lawyers. I couldn't find it in an American dictionary. Maybe there I couldn't find it.
I was going to ask that. Do you think the average lawyer even understands this?
Nope, not at all. And when you start going through, there are very specific ways in which, you know, if these things are grouped together, they mean this. If these things are excluded, then it means those are not. And you know, you read it and piece it together and go, okay, now I understand what that sentence or paragraph in the law means.
Got it.
But if you deceive and defraud the people, and especially if their attorneys can't help them, then this is overwhelmingly successful in a hoax upon the American people, a fraud, a treason to their oath of office, a treason against all of us.
Sure. Yeah, I understand.
So, my ranch is safe. My little weekend place is not in danger of foreclosure. I want restitution for them taking my house. And so now, you know, I'm just trying to figure out where do you go when everybody has said, you're such a jerk, go away, but I wouldn't go away.
John, this is extraordinary. You did lose the house, but you've got your little getaway.
I got my getaway. And I have grounds for getting my house back.
They owe you a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah,
but how are
they
gonna how are they going to recover and pay you for the grief they've caused you?
Well, you know, Jeff, that's a great question, because I look at the grief and I kind of have almost a stoic answer on that. And that, you know, if you do great things in life, you know, we had these signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
And they pledged their life, their liberty, and their sacred honor.
Absolutely.
They kept their sacred honor.
They kept that.
Many of them lost their life. They lost their property.
Yeah.
You know, I remember one general was, you know, looking at a house and said, you know, the British are, they've got their headquarters over there. And his aide said, you need to shell it, you know, with the cannon. He goes, that's your house. He says, I know, but the British are in it. And it's like, you know, they're just sacrifices you make in the defense of liberty. And what's more important, you know, rules or regulations on the American people don't apply if they're statutes that just relate to the District of Columbia. And if no one else discovered that, I've done a great service in my life, and it was worth it. It is worth it.
Wow. Selfless to a fault and generous.
No,
oh,
but
no. You have fought a battle for everyone. Why is the system not corrected? Why is it left with this huge, if you can find it, flaw?
So, number one, you can't find it, and I'm sure that they didn't think anybody would ever discover it, because, like I say, the rules of statutory construction are the key, okay? And then you got to know which statutes to look at. There's this little tiny one in 1864 and one in 1868, and so on. You've got to find these things. And then you have to figure out, as they twisted the laws all the way through. But, you know, Jeff, I've really thought about this. And if you talk with people, do you know what they want? They want you to pay your taxes because they're paying their taxes. And it's frustrating, because the tax system is a hoax. The hoax of federal jurisdiction allows them to perform organized crime. I mean, they're all in on it. And there's massive amounts of money flowing into Washington that, you know, it's our resources, our assets, our lifeblood. It's organized crime to take it from us. And that's honestly why I put together the website. The website is supremecourtcase.wordpress, that's all one word there, .com. because I put all the documents that I have filed in that website. And people can just go look at it and say, oh, I see that. That applies to me. Because that's the only way they're going to get around the fraud and the organized crime, is they're going to have to be able to box this giant into a corner where it can just say, see ya, bye.
This is, and that's what they've done. This is absolutely incredible. All the more reason for me to point out again that John has put his story in micro on the homepage at Rents, and you can read it and go to his website. It's all there. And I'm sure a lot of you will be more than interested in this. It's clearly one of the biggest frauds in modern history.
Jeff, I think it's the biggest fraud in history. I mean, you know, the banking system has its own set of frauds and all this, but to pull a fraud like this on the history of the American people and have them all stand in line to go, and they get a dribble back from what they spend in taxes.
Yeah. What one quick question. What do you think the current compliance percentage is? So many people out of work, so many people have no money. That's supposed to be a big secret.
You know, I don't know, but it's got to be a bunch, because people literally can't afford it when they're squeezing blood out of a turnip.
Exactly.
And, you know, you have to remember, you're going to go before a federal judge, okay?
Yeah.
And the only attorneys who can become a judge must swear a fealty to the Federal Reserve. I mean, they're protecting the banks in this. This is what the whole organized crime is about. Is the money goes to the Federal Reserve, okay?
It all goes to, and we know who the Federal Reserve is, so.
Exactly. And the U.S. government is the slave of the Federal Reserve. That's its creditor. That's where all these $19 trillion have come from. That's the federal debt that keeps getting bigger by $2 million a minute.
Oh, people, are we in trouble?
The founding fathers said the Constitution gives capacity to these courts for this and that, and that's it. Done. The American people are free of all that, and then a private bank now is taking the lifeblood of the American people.
A private Zionist bank.
That could well be, huh? The Federal Reserve has a very checkered history. The creature of Jekyll Island.
The creature lives, and...
Yes.
Don't know how to thank you, John, on behalf of all American patriots for what you've done and what you've been through. Keep at it, and I hope restitution comes soon and is appropriate, and you get to live a wonderful life. You've been through.
Well, thanks. I've been incredibly blessed by God in my life, and knowing people like you is one of the great blessings, and I do appreciate you're giving me the opportunity to share the story, Jeff.
Absolutely, John. We'll talk again. You keep
Please.
At it. Let me know what's going on.
Thanks, sir. Thank you. I will. I will for sure.
Okay, John. Thanks.
Thanks.
John Trowbridge, and what a story. All right, we'll be right back. Hang on.